You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Lacrosse Boots. Now, if you haven't heard yet, this is me telling you, you need to take a look at the new boots from Lacrosse, and they fall under the Navigator series. Now, what they've done is they've taken the best parts of a rubber boot and the best parts of your traditional hiking and hunting boot, and they've mashed them together to come up with this new line of boots from Lacrosse, and that is the Navigator series. Now, they have the women's Windrose, they have the men's Windrose, and then they have the Atlas series within that as well. So go to lacrossefootwear.com and check out this new line of boots that they have. I've been using mine for a couple weeks now, and I am very impressed with the fit and the feel, and I can't wait to get them in the woods this hunting season and give them a trial run. So lacrossefootwear.com, check them out.
I'm excited. This is my first podcast, so...
That was going to be a question. This is your first podcast. So much fun.
First podcast. Yeah.
Which is more nerve-wracking, this podcast or being featured in the New York Times?
Cooking for Melissa Clark was pretty nerve-wracking. Cooking for her in person and wanting to nail a steak at a perfect medium rare for somebody who's written over 35 cookbooks, I think that took the cake on one of the more nerve-wracking moments of my life.
Oh my goodness, I would be shaking in my boots.
Welcome to the Huntivore Podcast, episode 31, from Salad Snacker to Joint Breaker. Nick chats with founder of Western Daughters Meat Shop, Kate Cavanaugh. Recently, she was a feature in the New York Times for her very interesting story of becoming a strict vegetarian in her youth to owning and operating a whole animal butcher shop in Colorado. This episode takes a few tangents into views on agriculture and domestic meats, some historical reasons why regenerative ag is a good idea, and Kate also lays out some incredible tips for hunters and hits us with some meal ideas that'll blow your mind. While we don't get into any how-tos when it comes to chasing our quarry, it's some great food for thought to think about as hunters, what we are doing and how we are doing it and how it affects everything around us. So sit back and enjoy. Well, hey, good evening, folks. Beautiful evening here in Michigan. I'm sitting digitally across from a very, very interesting person. She has gone from Salad Snacker to Joint Breaker. She was a feature in the New York Times. She has a huge heart for the environment, all while getting full use out of a shoulder clod. I want to give it up to Kate Cavanaugh, all the way from Colorado. Kate, thank you for joining us this evening.
Nick, thank you so much for having me, and what a fantastic introduction. I appreciate being a joint breaker. It's one of my favorite butchery things to do.
Because that's one of your specialties there at, let me get it right, Western Daughters. That's your shop?
Yeah, Western Daughters Butcher Shop here in Denver, Colorado.
And you guys are into full animal butchery, am I right? You bring the whole thing in and you're getting every cut out of it.
That is correct. So we butcher everything in house from nose to tail. And we only take in whole animals, and we use as much as we possibly can and pride ourselves on that fact.
That's a great undertaking. We're going to get into that, but I first want to back up and I want to get into your story. I came across the New York Times article where they featured you and several other butchers in there. And your story started out where you came from a background of, I care for the environment, so I'm going to drastically change what I eat. And then through those same convictions came full circle back to being a butcher. Tell us some of the details on your journey going from vegetarianism to cutting up full animals.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a story that kind of spans about a 15 to 20 year chunk of time. I decided that I wanted to be a vegetarian when I was a little kid. It's a very passionate, very tender-hearted child, and it all started with the movie Babe, which I saw when I was 5, and I proclaimed at that moment that I wanted to be a vegetarian from there on out. And my parents were willing participants and let me make that decision for myself and hold to it. And for about the next 10 years, I would save up my allowance to save turkeys around Thanksgiving, and was just a very passionate vegetarian from the standpoint of animal welfare. And as I got a little bit older, as I got into my teenage years, it kind of morphed into this idea of, was also concerned about the environment and what kind of toll was animal agriculture and different types of agriculture having on greenhouse gas emissions and climate change and just soil retention, and maintaining beautiful land here in the United States. And so I became really concerned about that, and it actually led me into studying biology and sustainability in college. I was so passionate about it. And as college was starting to wrap up, I was about 20 years old, so it's about 15 years later. So as college was starting to wrap up, I was looking at what I was going to do after college and was looking some at becoming a large animal vet and was looking a little bit about going into land management. I had become just really fascinated by the idea of how food can be a byproduct of conservation. And especially coming from Colorado and having this half of the state that was the plains that I really loved to hike in and to spend time in when I was growing up, I wanted to know more about how to restore prairie landscapes. And as I started doing research, one of the best ways to really restore native grasslands is to run cattle on it. And so I became really interested in this idea of regenerative agriculture and food as a byproduct of conservation, and started seeking out farms and ranches and looking for sort of a different way of eating meat, and made the decision that I wanted to start consuming meat again that came from these regenerative focused farms and ranches. And so I started eating meat and just really fell in love with the food system and with cooking and with all of these different components, and decided that I wanted to dive more into it by becoming a butcher.
That's a great story. I love the part where you're getting on that forward thinking of regenerative agriculture. That seems to be the new wave. I shouldn't say the new wave. It's been coming, and people are studying it and finding more about it. But how we've gone from one extreme to how much can we pull from this to the new extreme of, okay, how can we sustain this?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that it's definitely something that's people are learning a little bit more about and becoming a little bit more curious about. And I think one of the most fascinating things is that yields in a lot of industrial sectors are actually down, and oftentimes switching into a more regenerative and multi-species, multi-crop system tends to bring yields up. And so I think that we can chase both, you know, better yields, but also something that's better for the land. And so I just think it's a really exciting part of agriculture.
That's great. That's great. So yeah, Western Daughters starts up as the new butcher shop. And I'm sure this is going to be no surprise question to you. Tell me about being a female in the industry of being a butcher. Traditionally, that's held by men. What's it like being a lady with a cleaver?
You know, Nick, I get this question a lot, and I'm never exactly sure how to answer it. I think it was difficult starting out in this industry being a woman, not just being a woman, but being a young woman. When my partner and I started Western Daughters, I was 24. And so I had a lot of hurdles in being taken seriously. And I think that just gave me a lot of motivation to seek out more knowledge and to be the most knowledgeable person in the room about my trade. And so in some ways, I'm grateful that it had this aspect of kind of pushing me. There were times it was hard to be taken seriously. I think especially across the counter, oftentimes when customers are coming into a butcher shop and looking for a butcher, they don't always expect to find a young woman. But we really pride ourselves on bringing women into the industry at Western Daughters. And together, my partner and I have trained over a dozen women how to cut meat.
Excellent. And I mean, what better training? That you were looking at to large animal vet as being a large animal vet. What better training for knowing the inner workings of an animal and how it's put together than that type of schooling?
Yeah.
What else did you go as far as like training? Either, you know, did you go into like a butcher trade school, or was there some sort of mentor that you were following at first?
Yeah, so my partner and I worked in a butcher shop in upstate New York, and we had an incredible mentor named Brian Mayer, who's still out there training butchers, and worked under him for about a year. And it was an interesting experience, I think, with butchering. I'm going to be honest. I don't think you really necessarily have to go to trade school. This is something that we've been doing for tens of thousands of years. And I don't have to tell your audience that when you're cutting meat, there is something intuitive about it. And there is something about when you get into a carcass and finding your way around that animal, you can kind of start to see where things connect and where things want to fall apart. And all of those bits and pieces. But in order to gain some speed and some extra knowledge, we did spend a year training.
Good deal. Yeah, having someone who knows their way with a boning knife and through joints. I think I watched a 30-minute video on one of my, you know, digital mentors, Scott Ree. He never used a saw. He used just a boning knife and took apart an entire hog. And it was just like, holy smokes. He never cut anything. Oh, yeah. With the saw, he just worked his blade through. It's amazing how that animal wants to fall apart once it's put into a carcass.
It really does. And that's totally, that's something that I can also do, is take it apart without a bone saw, though they're certainly nice to have. And I think it has all these seams and it fits together like this puzzle, and it begins to become a sort of logical thing about how you take the puzzle apart. And so it does just kind of want to fall apart.
Well, good deal. So we got into the training of it. Again, with your convictions of really like, hey, we can do this a better way. You've got some strong attitudes towards this regenerative agriculture versus the, you know, agribusiness that has come about. What's your attitude towards our meat industry as it sits right now, merely on the domestic side? How do you feel we're handling our beef, our pork, our chicken?
It's a big question, and I think that there are a lot of nuances, and it's something that we could talk about for hours. I think in general that we, you know, over the last 60, 70 years, really since the end of World War II and the Green Revolution, we've really shifted into this industrial model that's all about scale. How much can we produce? How fat can we get it? And how quickly can we make it fat? And so we've started slaughtering animals younger and younger. We've started using a lot of sources in their diet that wouldn't naturally be in their diet, just from the standpoint of their digestive system and what they evolved eating. And just really moved out from the sort of system that we were a part of this ecosystem. We've kind of corralled things off into feedlots, or in the case of pork, into massive barns, same with chicken, and stopped sort of using the interplay of animals in an ecosystem creating food. And I think that in a lot of that, we've lost a chance both for some ethical treatment of animals. We've given some animals lives that I don't think any of us would wish for ourselves or any of our pets. And we've also created a fair amount of destruction of just our soil and our land. And so not a huge fan of industrial meat production, needless to say.
I figured as much.
But I also think that there's a better way. And I think it's a way that, you know, agriculture got going about 10,000 years ago. And it's what really allowed us to settle down into cities and into urban centers, right? That we could really anchor down and create our own food system around us. And I think that we very much have that potential to create that again. And so I'm passionate to be in this system because I think that there's so much that we can get back to, as well as creating some new paths as well.
Excellent. Yeah, that's, I mean, just kind of where my audience is from is that we go out and we seek out our animals for prey. You know, we're going to try and take them out as quickly and as efficiently as possible. But at the same time, they're growing up in a very diverse diet. We'd like to say that our bucks are old, but usually it's the little buck that walks in front of you that you end up taking. But at the same time, that, you know, year old to 2 year old buck is still maybe twice as old as a steer coming out of a feedlot. So you've got you're coming out with a maturity there. You're getting something with a diverse taste palate. You're getting meat that's super dark because it's been used versus an animal. As one of my mentors that I've been seeking is Hank Shaw. He says, everything tastes like corn. Everybody loves corn. And that's what we're accustomed to. So having something that's different, that's complex is what my audience is after, at least as a hunting standpoint. So it's great to know that even in a domestic livestock, that there are whispers, there are trends where it's saying, let's get back to that. Let's get some older cattle in here. Let's bring about a more diverse diet that's going to be healthy for the animal and at the same time make our food more interesting.
You touched on so many pieces of that I'd love to kind of tease out with you. One of the first things that you touched on was these animals, when you're hunting, they're eating a natural diet. You know, it's what they would eat in the wild and it fits with their digestive system. And I think that when you're looking at ruminants, which whether you're a hunter or a butcher, we're looking at these animals with this multi-chambered stomach that's acting more like a fermentation tank in some ways than it is like our digestive system, which we're monogastric animals, so are pigs. But these ruminants, whether you're talking about deer or elk or pronghorn or cattle or sheep, are all attuned to eating grass. And they have actually kind of a fascinating magical digestive system that allows them to do that. And it's part fermentation and it has a lot of reactions with actually fungi that are in their first rumen and all of these different bacteria and enzymes that allows them to take grass, which is really just cellulose, and break it down and turn it into meat and fat. And so you touched on that, and I think that's an important thing that we're looking for at Western Daughters is that are these animals eating a diet that they would be eating if they were wild, even though they are domesticated?
Yeah, I do laugh at some point because I do get some people who come in and they're like, oh my, like eating wild game is purely organic, you know, and I snicker about it because here going across to, you know, a cornfield, you know, I'm sure that corn is, you know, GMO laced. I mean, that's probably got several hybrids going along, but oh yeah, that sucker, he's true organic right now.
True organic. Yeah. And you know, I think at this point in time, I think you would be hard pressed to find anything that hadn't been contaminated in one way or another with glyphosate, which is the herbicide and pesticide that's most used. It's commonly known as Roundup, that there is no more true organic quite. So that's funny. You touched on another thing I wanted to bring up, which is flavor. And Hank Shaw, who is great. I met Hank Shaw a couple of years ago, and I just think he's such an incredible author and chef. And flavor is a really big part of this. And we have grown accustomed to that corn taste. And one of the things I hear the most at Western Daughters is customers coming back and saying, oh, that was so beefy. That beef was so beefy. Or that chicken was just, it was really tasted like chicken. And so, I mean, I think the beautiful thing when you're talking about animals raised in a regenerative system, eating the type of thing that they are built and evolved to eat, or talking about wild game is you get so much more flavor.
You definitely do. Going back to the article here real quick, quote that I put down from you, and just with your attitudes, Thor, that you've just been talking about with the meat industry and how everything's kind of tasted up or tasting the same, and it's stripping from as opposed to building up, is kind of in your venture here. I'm, and this is me quoting you, I'm basically in this to turn the conventional meat industry on its head. Is that, that's your mission that you're going here at Western Daughters. What are you doing as far as picking these animals that you want to bring into your butcher shop? As you're selecting the livestock that you're bringing in, you know, this is your moment to definitely turn the meat industry on its head. What type of animals are you looking to bring into your shop? Is it just diet you're looking at, or are you looking at just conditions? Talk to me how you're looking at bringing in your livestock.
Yeah, so we kind of have a system that my partner Josh and I have developed, that's really just a lot about connection. And so we look at a couple of different things. Is it good for the land? And so this means, is it helping to regenerate topsoil and to preserve and diversify even ecosystems with regenerative grazing practices? Is it good for the animal? So do they have unfettered access to outdoors, dirt, sunshine, walking around, using their muscles, which was another point you touched on, when you're eating wild game. Those used muscles create a lot of flavor. And then is it good for the farmer? I think that in my industry especially, we talk a lot about environmental sustainability, but if this isn't financially sustainable in the meat industry, then it's not going to continue to be environmentally sustainable. So it has to be good for the rancher and the farmer and be in a system that works for them. And ultimately, if you have those three things, the meat is good from a nutrition standpoint for the consumer. And it's packed full of omega-3s and conjugated linoleic acids and all these great trace minerals and nutrients. And so it's really those three things and that we look for. And from there, to us, this is really about human connection, and the connection to our food system, which I think is something that we've lost touch with in today's industrial agricultural production. And so we go out and we meet farmers and ranchers and we talk to them and we sit down and have dinner with their families and we build relationships. And so that's really at the core of looking for what we're going to bring in, is looking for that connection point between our business and their business and between us as human beings and our beliefs and value systems. And then just kind of doing the rest on a handshake.
There you go. I love what you said too, as far as it's, you know, you want to make sure that you're including people into their choices as far as being a meat eater. You know, you can get so separated from your food. Just as you were saying, you go into the supermarket and you find, you know, a steak that's pre-wrapped. It doesn't look like an animal. It looks like a steak. This is what you're going to get for. But at the same time, you know, you walk into Western Daughters and you're going to see a whole hindquarter probably laying back there on the block getting worked on, that you can't not say that is a leg from an animal. And to have that connection to say, like, we're eating meat. This is something had to give its life up, you know, to have at least the knowledge of that, and to, I don't want to say necessarily grab the guilt along with it, but at the same time acknowledge this critter gave its life so that it can be then basically taken apart and then given life to who knows how many people get a piece of that particular animal. So that's great to know that that's going on, and that the education towards your customers are coming in, and the farmer's a full part of that, that they get to have a handshake, they get to know the person cutting it up, and to know that it's going to be fully utilized. That's a great thing.
I think what you said is really important. That connection to the animal, that this is actually an animal and it's recognizable as that when you come into the shop and you're looking at the back table and there's a round of beef or half a hog, whatever it is, on the table. And I do think that we've gotten to this space where it feels like pork just comes from a pork chop tree and you just pick it up at the grocery store and it's plastic wrapped and has this styrofoam bottom and we don't really think about where it came from. And so at Western Daughters, we really see part of our job is to tell stories about our food system, both about our local farmers and ranchers that we work with. And everybody's within about a 150-mile radius. And so they're all close to home and in our customer's backyard. But we get to tell stories about our food system and where food comes from and what it means to actually get from farm to table. Because there are a lot of steps along the way and honoring that life cycle and that process and that death that has occurred in order for us to eat is all a part of that.
Well, hey, while we got you here, thanks again for listening. Dustin, where can our listeners engage more with us?
They can check us out on Instagram at Huntivore. They can check us out on Facebook, The Huntivore. Or send us an email at huntivore@gmail.com.
We've also joined the Sportsman's Nation family of passionate outdoorsmen. They come together with lots of great content. You can check out their website at sportsmansnation.com. They're also on Instagram and Facebook with the handle Sportsman's Nation. In fact, if you check out their blog, we have a recipes already up. And they are a 2% for conservation company, which means as a business, they give 1% of their time and 1% of their earnings back to the wildlife and wild places that we love. I think that's pretty sweet. Anyway, back to the show.
You mentioned earlier, too, you're very passionate about the east side of Colorado, that everybody, they land in Denver and they're heading west to the mountains. Everything's out in months, so either, you know, Vail and Aspen for the skiing or yep. Everybody wants to go and, you know, chase elk up a mountain. But, you know, some love needs to be given to the east side of Colorado. And just given your trade and how much the cattle have run up and down, or even, you know, an eon ago, we had bison running up and down. You said a stat earlier when we were talking that the U.S., 40% of it used to be prairie. And since then, it's been, you know, chopped and hacked between either residential, or now it's into smaller scale farming operations. But at one time, we had mass amounts of grassland. And you have a huge passion for that. Tell me about what's so important about the health of a land and having good, deep soil.
Yeah. So I love this statistic, and I feel like we don't talk about prairies and grasslands when we talk about ecosystems much. And 40% is a huge number. That's almost half of the United States that used to be covered in grasslands. And had millions of bison roaming around it. And that's a really important part of this equation because one can't really exist without the other. You need ruminants, both bison, elk, deer, pronghorn, roaming a grassland for it to be healthy and to flourish. And they need the grass from that land in order to maintain and live and eat. And so... grasslands are really cool. What happens with grass is you get a large mix. Here's tall and short grass prairie. Used to be 40%. Now there's less than 1% of the United States is prairie, just for listeners that might be curious about that. And grass eat carbon molecules out of the air, similar to forest. We talk a lot about forest sequestering carbon, but grasslands have a massive... they're a massive machine for sequestering carbon. And so they eat these carbon molecules and they put them deep into the soil and take carbon out of the Earth's atmosphere. And then simultaneously what's happening is inside of the soil, they're growing these massive root systems and creating these whole sort of universes and worlds beneath our feet And so these root systems can reach down up to 20 feet deep. And I encourage all of your listeners to look up prairie grass roots because they're just incredible. And they're searching for water. And then their roots break up soil and allow all of these different soil organisms and bacteria and tardigrades to survive and create pockets in the soil that allows for a lot of water absorption. And so if you take a space of well-managed prairie and look at how quickly it absorbs a gallon of water, there's kind of this whole little rig they have to measure this. It absorbs it almost instantaneously. But what happened as westward expansion kind of came online and we started moving west and looking at this land, and we were like, well, what are we going to grow here? Because all that grows is this tough, inedible grass. That prior to this, the bison and all the ruminants of the plains have been eating. And we started tilling the soil and began to grow grain on it. And it was a difficult endeavor because not a lot grows very well on this space of land other than grass. It's really hard to cultivate. It's really hard to make it productive. And we really quickly burned it out. And that's when the Dust Bowl happened. And so all of our topsoil that this grass had been holding down, all of the capability of the land to absorb water and ultimately absorb carbon had been lost and it all kind of blown away. And so I'm really passionate about how we utilize this land in a way that makes sense and that is good for the soil in terms of what those root systems have to offer and good for the environment in terms of sequestering carbon. There are estimates that all the grasslands of the world have the power to harness more carbon than rainforests and forests put together. It's about 39 to 50% grasslands, Earth's usable landmass. And so it's a big force for change. And I really believe that by harnessing that and looking at that relationship that I was talking about earlier between bison or ruminants and grasses is really at the heart of that.
You mentioned earlier that Dust Bowl, and I forget the speaker, right there, I think around, it was either the mid 30s or the early 40s, but there was a large storm that came from the Midwest. Yeah. And it's blowing the dust. And I forget the name of the speaker. I was trying to quickly look it up. And it's escaping me. But he waited an hour before he went into Congress to let the dust hit Washington, D.C.
He stalled.
Yeah.
He was stalling because he wanted, and I forget what exactly he was trying to pass, but we changed a lot of the way that land is utilized during that time in the early 30s after the Dust Bowl. And he did. He stalled in Congress. He was talking and he just kept talking because this massive storm was blowing onto the East Coast and it blacked out the windows of Congress. And what a powerful message, right?
Exactly. As someone who, now I think I'm in the media, I guess, like I look at stories like that and I'm like, what a way to send a message is to not only be able to be up there and talk about it, but be like, look out the windows because it's so dark. You can't see out them. Look at all the dust. This is for real. And just how hard that hit lawmakers at that point to say like, man, we need to take care of what we have because it's literally blowing away.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that we're at that same kind of turning point that we were at then, that a lot of what we've done to our land is starting to show, and that we have to make some changes to the way that we grow food. And when I want to turn the conventional meat industry on its head, that's really what I mean. I want to find a different way of growing food that can be beneficial for the landscape, both in terms of meat and other things, but especially because I think that meat plays such a key part in this. With that statistic of 40% used to be grasslands, and really the only thing that grasslands can sustain easily is our ruminants. And so I think that relationship is something we should be moving back towards.
Good deal. So here we are. We got a group of hunters that are listening, individuals who take full advantage and full responsibility of acquiring that animal. We're not shy about it. We chase down the animal, and as much as the slaughterman goes about his job, there's a bit of him that feels for that animal that he's putting down, and we feel that same thing. And our attitude towards fully utilizing that animal, because this is gonna sustain us all year. If we're making the choice to look outside of domestic meat. Now, granted, if we're unsuccessful, sure enough, we got to head over to Western Daughters and find ourselves a half a hog. But at the same time, we want to take this undertaking as someone huge into animal ethics. What are your views on hunting and fishing? Is this part of the regenerative process, or are we part of the problem?
I think that this is 100% a part of the regenerative process. I think that hunters and fishermen are alongside ranchers, the original land stewards. That the desire to hunt, to fish, and to raise animals on the side of ranchers comes from a deep love of land and environment and a feeling of stewardship. And I think that hunters play an incredibly important role in that. And I think that also are leading the way at looking at being more connected to a food system. I don't think anybody has a better idea of what it means to participate in their food system and in their environment than a hunter.
Good deal. Have you been hunting yet, Kate?
I haven't. You know, that's been on my, it's honestly been on the top of my list for years. And I'm a fair marksman. Getting my license and pulling a tag is at the top of my list. And now that we're 6 years into Western Daughters, I feel like next year will be the first time that I will finally get to do that. But something I would be very excited to experience.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad it's on your bucket list there that you're going to be able to partake in that. Another question I'm going to come to you, and this is going to include a bit of your past and kind of our present too, is at the same time with social media being an amazing tool, it's also one thing that, man, you just don't press send. You write something down and you're like, man, I want that back. It's like toothpaste out of a tube. You can't put it back. It's already out there for the world to see. And I feel like sometimes we trick ourselves as hunters that we go on there and we poke fun at vegetarians and vegans. And at the same time, they do their fair share of prodding back. And it is. It's a back and forth. It's two worlds apart. It's one of those things we're just gonna butt heads. But at the same time, coming from both worlds, where is our common ground as meat eaters and as carnivores that are pursuing our game outside of a domestic aspect that we are hopefully trying to be part of the regenerative process? How are we on the same page with folks who are making choices to not eat meat? What's our common ground?
I thought about this question a lot, and I'm kind of just like to start a dialogue because I'm not sure I have the best answer, but I think that really there is a lot of common ground in a couple of different ways. And I think the first way that hunters and vegans and vegetarians kind of share common ground is that they're looking at the system and they're going outside of norms. So the vast majority of the population is omnivorous and does not hunt. And so I think that both sides of the equation, you're looking at the food system and you're taking action to change what you feel like you can change about it or participate in it in a different way. And so I think that's the first thing. And I think that a lot of hunters and vegetarians and vegans would actually share a lot of environmental concerns in terms of just losing wilderness and a concern for land stewardship. But I think it's just so hard to find common ground. And I think more and more it's becoming important that we try to put ourselves in the shoes of the other side and to try to see it from a different direction. But those are the two things that I think are most shared between the two camps.
Awesome. I've got a personal story. Good friend of mine from college. We're both Detroit Lions fans. And so we have to stick together because our team is literally falling apart. But at the same time, we find totally two different camps where he's leading on the vegetarian side and wanting to be completely absent of animal use, you know, leaning towards the vegan side of it. He doesn't want to be part of the pain and suffering of an animal. At the same time, on the other end, he's got a buddy who is, you know, working on the most efficient, effective plan to basically put a projectile through an animal and kill it. And so even though I try to explain my side of it, I'm still telling him that I'm killing an animal. But at the same time, I'm like, why doesn't he understand that I don't want pain to the animal? I want it to go down as quick as possible. There's a lot of hurdles, just like you were saying, but I think at the same time, it comes down to that we're fully thinking about the animal. We're thinking about the conservation piece. And I think as a hunting population, that's been kind of the big drum that's being beaten right now is conservation. We want this to stick around and we're watching it. We're watching it fall apart. And so as much as we want to be able to stick it together, we're also talking to a population that doesn't have involvement other than heading to the grocery store and pulling their meat out and then asking questions of, well, is this environmentally friendly? They don't care at that point.
Did it suffer?
Yes. They're not asking those questions. So I think it's great that at least that's going to be some common ground. At least we have that our common ground is the animal, is the environment, but we got to hear each other out.
I think you also touched on another point that my partner and I talk a lot about just at home over dinner in terms of this. We do have something else in common between hunters and vegans and vegetarians, and that is death. And I know that probably sounds really abrupt and aggressive, but death is an intricate part of our food system. Whether you're talking about a monocrop of soy that's meant for a Beyond Burger and the amount of life and ecosystem that's displacing. Or whether you're talking about how many animals are hurt in the tilling and combine use in bigger industrial production. And I think that part of that piece where we've gotten so far removed from our food system, that I think hunters can really lead the charge on bringing us back into is that there are full life cycles, that there is birth and life and death in this food system. And they all play important parts. And even just looking at one of my favorite things to talk about is fertilizer. And so we use fertilizer made out of fossil fuels ever since the Green Revolution. And it used to be blood and bones. You know, for all the gardeners out there, you use blood meal and bone meal because animal carcasses are the best fertilizer for your soil to grow vegetables. And so I think that there is some common ground, and I can certainly speak to this coming from as a vegetarian and certainly not to get into it, but I was very death averse for a multitude of reasons and things that had happened in my childhood. And I think that's fairly common amongst that community, is just not wanting to imagine it or deal with it or see it. And I really respect that the hunting community brings in this idea of, well, that's part of it. And nobody wants pain and suffering for these creatures.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail right there on the head, is that we don't want the pain and suffering, but at the same time, we still got to know that, yeah, death is at the doorstep and we got to talk about it.
You know? Yeah. And there's so much respect in that moment. While I haven't done any hunting, I've done my fair share of on farm slaughter and harvest. And that moment is a very intimate moment between you and your food system. I think that intimacy is important.
How do farmers take that, or ranchers? They call you in to be the slaughterman. How are they taking it?
So I haven't done a lot of that, so I won't speak to this from a space of having done a lot of on-farm slaughter, or slaughter in general. But I think with a similar reverence that you just spoke to, that they honor that this was a life, and I think it can feel maybe a little bit sad, but wanting to honor it and wanting to give it the best possibility of being used and giving back, afterwards. So I think it's very similar to how hunters feel.
Excellent. We're going to switch gears now, and the animal is now down. We've been through this death episode. There's a transition, and it's funny how it works. You go from this animal being an animal, a living, breathing creature, and at some point along the way, it becomes a carcass. It's now a product that needs to be taken care of, that now this is the harvest. You know, we always talk about as hunters, we harvest, like, you know, killing the animal, that's legitimately killing the animal. But now we're into, I've got flesh and bone in front of me. And I think us as hunters, we're split maybe 60-40 or 50-50. I've got some friends who take their animal into the processor, because the undertaking of cutting your own animal is one that A, they're intimidated by, and B, they don't want to screw it up. They've got, how many tags can you get out in Colorado as a Colorado resident? One or two?
I think you can get two, but don't quote me on that.
Gotcha. So you can get two here. You can get a combo tag here in Michigan, and you can get subsequent doe tags. But at the same time, you have a finite amount of venison. I'm referring strictly to venison at this point, as far as deer goes, but even for waterfowl or whatever, we revere it so much that sometimes that's a deterrent, because we want somebody who's knowledgeable to take care of it. What are some advice that you would give to hunters who've got their game and who now want to butcher it themselves? How do they get over some of these hurdles, and what should they look at as far as helping them out?
Yeah, so we've led a lot of hunter workshops over the years. And what we do is we usually take a group of hunters and we take a lamb, which is similar enough in terms of anatomy, and teach hunters how to break down. And so I have a couple of thoughts on this, and feel free to sort of pause me if you have questions or want me to get more into something. I think first and foremost, just knowing that there is an intuitive nature to this, that once you get to that point where it is a carcass and you're starting to break it down, that you will see how it fits together and be able to take it apart. And I think that getting to participate in that piece can be really exciting, and it can be really meaningful. We've encouraged a lot of hunters to go through the butchery process. And I think from there, the biggest question is if you're hauling out and you're going to take stuff with bone in, or if you're just trying to get meat off the carcass in order to reduce the load that you're carrying out. And that's kind of question number one. And that makes it different if you're going to do bone in or if you're going to do the whole thing bone out. If you're going to do it bone in, the most important thing is that you're getting stuff into manageable sized pieces. I think a bone saw is really handy in this situation, though you can certainly do it without one. And just trying to get stuff into square and manageable pieces that you can pack into a cooler or wherever it needs to go. And then if you're going the bone out route, just really gaining some practice, maybe at home, with that boning knife, because there your game is trying to get as much meat off the bone as possible. And so those are two of my biggest things, but I'm happy to go more into it.
No, No, that's a great starting point. For Colorado, elk being so abundant and mule deer being the main ungulate out there, this idea of carrying the animal out is an undertaking. You know, you're up in the mountains and
absolutely,
you know, boom, bam, I got a 1200 pound animal laying right here. Absolutely. And I got to carry it back. So those, yeah. What you're saying is your choice now, bone in, bone out. How are we going to do this? Well, how many miles am I away from the truck? That's, or how close can I get the truck to us?
Exactly. And I think that, you know, either way, great choice. And I think it's really just informed by your situation. You know, if you're going bone out, one of my biggest tips is that bone skin and the ability to peel muscle from bone is going to be your best friend in terms of getting every last bit of meat off of that carcass.
Here in Michigan, we've got whitetails, a little bit more manageable. And at the same time, a lot of our temperature helps us out because right when season rolls around, we're starting to get snow on the ground, pretty much just opening up that cavity and allowing heat to escape naturally is usually how we can do it. We can hang them up outside, but at the same time, you put an animal down and it's not a, I mean, it is a bit of undertaking. You know, you get yourself a nice big deer and you got to drag it, you know, a quarter to, you know, maybe even a mile. Like, yeah, you put up a good sweat. But I like how you're saying, like, get them into manageable square parts. I'm looking for, and I've talked to several guys too, and they were looking for more steak to be added into their cuts. What are some hidden gems inside of maybe that you find in beef or even in wild game that gets brought into? Do you guys do wild game cutting at Western Daughters?
So we can't, just in terms of regulation, wild game and USDA processed meat can't share the same space, but we've done a lot of wild game processing privately for private clients.
Gotcha.
And I think getting more steaks is the universally what is wanted. And my general advice is there is so much great stuff, both in the leg and the shoulder, that can be used as steaks, and just as great cuts, that don't normally, get utilized that way.
Gotcha. I think there was a quote in the same article and they were talking about, I think you said, the flat iron was one of the more tender pieces of meat that you enjoyed as far as a steak. And I guess this alludes to how much I nerded out trying to do my own butchery. I got onto the University of Kentucky website and ended up finding the syllabus for the butcher program down there. And I searched out some of the resources just to find, like, how do I take apart a beef shoulder or a shoulder clod on a beef and then translate that into venison. I find myself like, do I really want to tell people I went this far with it? But
yes,
anyway,
you do. Yes, you want to tell people you went that far. I just think that's really admirable, and you're right, because there's so much going on in the, I mean, you have a teres major, you have the actual clod or the tricep muscle. You have the flat iron. You also have the underblade, which in beef we sometimes call a Vegas strip. You have the sort of chuck roll, which is really amazing, tied up and turned into steaks as kind of like a little copa roast. You hear that more associated with pork, but you just have all these little hidden gems inside of that shoulder. And I know that everybody wants more steak, and that is where you're going to find them.
Well, good, because that's, we find a lot of shoulder goes to a lot of grind, which there's nothing bad with good ground venison. I mean, we love it. And, a friend of mine once said that, you know, even if you do mess up, you just end up with more ground. So that means more burgers and more tacos, absolutely, which we all love.
Yeah. And I think that if you're going into butchering your own animal, I think the first thing to know is that if you mess up, it can either turn into stew or it can turn into grind and everything, or sausage, and everything is going to get used anyway. And so not to let it get in your head or make it feel too precious, because it's going to get used one way or the other.
when you're cutting up an animal at your shop, have you gone to getting very expensive cutlery, or are you more on the idea of that, hey, let's just get something cheap and functional and roll with it? Because I know I've got folks too that think that, you know what, well, I don't have the right equipment. I want to get myself a really nice blade. And as far as I look at it, that's a really nice blade that I'm going to end up breaking and dulling and having to just keep sharpening. What kind of cutlery are you using at Western Daughters?
So, Nick, I'm really passionate about this question. I'm really glad that you asked me. I think it's a very important question. And the answer is you do not need a fancy knife or fancy cutlery to do this. I have, for almost a decade now, exclusively used Victorinox knives with Fibrox handles, which are great for when you're in the field and your hands are wet and slipping. And I think for field dressing, a 5 or 6 inch semi-stiff curved boning knife from Victorinox is the perfect way to go. And they're less than $25 on Amazon.
Awesome. Yeah, I think there's two names out there. There's Victorinox and then Dexter. And I feel like both those, like they're both, yeah, they have that grippy rubber handle that, man, you can grab onto that and just pull right on through
in any situation. And I like the semi-stiff. I think that they afford you a lot more control. I've seen a lot of hunters come in with flex blades. And I think it's just harder to cut with, and it's harder to make things neat and to get nice lines out of. So I like those semi-stiff boned, curved boning knives.
Is presentation worth it? You know, we've come as these hunters, we're slash and hack. We're doing the best we can. Should a guy, if he's really trying to like up his game, really look at making those square cuts, really trying to pick up his presentation?
You know, I don't think presentation matters, because eventually you're going to be cooking and eating it, and you won't be able to tell anyway. I think the one thing that you have going for you when you're making stuff square is that you can generally get more cuts out of it. When you have a nice square cut to begin with, it means that those steaks can just keep going. Whereas if you have something angled, you just lose some of that meat. But it's all going to the same place. It's all going to our stomachs. So I don't think presentation is the end all be all.
This was almost a softball segue. Speaking of stomachs, we're at the crescendo of our talk here. We're at the two dish breakdown. And this is the portion of my show that every guest gets to basically lay out all the details on two dishes that they really know and that they really love. And they've got some categories that go along with it. Kate, your first dish that you're going to explain to us is, we were up there talking about those underused cuts, something from the shoulder. What fan favorite, what crowd favorite do you have that happens to be an underused cut, something from the shoulder? What are you making?
So I'm going to do a copa roast. So taking that chuck roll, I think is what it's going to be most commonly known as, tying it up about half inch staggered pieces of twine and cutting that into steaks. And when you're towards the rib side of that, that's what a Delmonico cut would be. But I think that these make just great steaks, especially with game, and they are just so underused and looked over.
Are those single muscle steaks, or like, because you're rolling and tying, you've got several basically muscle groups kind of grouped together? Is that what that is? Or is it one large group that I'm looking for?
So usually it's going to be the longissimus dorsi, which is that long, big muscle that we associate with like a ribeye or a New York strip. It goes through all the way up the spine. And then towards the rib side, you're going to have a little bit of the serratus ventralis, which we think of as the muscle that anchors our shoulder blades onto our back. And then a couple of other muscles. And oftentimes so it's just going to be kind of a roll with multiple muscles. And I think that's great, because hopefully you're getting just a little bit of intermuscular fat between them. And it's just a delicious cut. It has the right balance of work. It's not super tender, but it's definitely not toothy either. And so I just think it's a dreamy cut.
A dreamy cut. The Delmonico off the Copa roll is what you called it?
A chuck roll, I think, is the best way of putting it.
Gotcha.
It's the chuck roll.
It's the chuck roll. What are you seasoning it with? Just salt and pepper, or are you going something fancy?
So I am definitely going just salt. And this is one of my big things. So pepper bitters in the pan. And so if you're going to pepper, I always recommend that you pepper after. But with
pro tip right there, pepper afterwards.
Yeah, that's coming from my chef background. With great meat, all you need is salt. To me, salt in a hot cast iron skillet, and usually a little bit of fat, are all I use to cook steak.
Hey, keep it simple. That's the way. Let the meat sing, huh?
Absolutely. Yeah, and then I think it's what you pair it with. And for me, that really depends on the season. Like right now, I think I'd reduce some peaches and plums into a bit of a chutney and serve it with that, because we have some beautiful stone fruit out here in Colorado right now, and just a nice big salad filled with garden vegetables.
Gotcha. What kind of lettuce are you using? Arugula?
Arugula? Arugula. We did have a discussion about how to pronounce this earlier on. Arugula. I'm often using, but it depends. I really like mustard greens. I like some funny versions of lettuce. I like a spicy lettuce.
Yeah. Those mustard greens, they really add a zip to it. They got some bitter notes, which, yeah, they really help.
Yeah, which I think really, really brings out some of the beautiful lush notes in game meat.
Here's our second breakdown. And this one gets a little bit, we need some more details on this one. And this is your date night meal. So the chickens have been put in the coop. The cats are away doing their own thing. And it's just you and the mister. It's just you and your partner staying in tonight. And you happen to be cooking. But you're looking for this night to just go just right. What are you making and what's going with it? And make sure not to leave out the details.
I will not leave out the details. But first of all, if I'm cooking dinner, the chickens aren't quite in the coop yet. Usually we like to start date night around 5 or 6. It depends on the season, but they're not in bed until about 8 these days.
Oh, gotcha.
So first of all, me and the mister like to cook together. For us, that's part of date night. I think it's a really cool chance to connect and to do something that's a little bit technical and a little bit creative together. And so date night always begins with both of us cooking together. That being said, to me, there's a big question on what I'm cooking depends wholly on the season and what's in season and what's just around me. And so if it were going to be tonight, I think we would probably be having Bavette steaks, which is one of my favorite underappreciated cuts, kind of from the drop loin, from the flap, sometimes called flap meat. And it's just got this beautiful grain, super delicious. And I'd be doing with those with my partner, and I actually foraged about 30 pounds of hawkwing mushrooms on Monday. They're sometimes called pheasant's backs, and they're just really rich and mushroomy and awesome. And so I'd be cooking those up with some tarragon and some ghee, and then a big salad, probably a little bit of, we grow lettuces, so a little bit of mizuna and a little bit of red mustard and a little bit of arugula. From the garden with just mandolin plums. With salads, my mandolin is my favorite tool. And I just take all the vegetables from our garden and thinly shave them into salad. So plums, carrots, some yellow beets, some radishes, and then just heaps and heaps of basil with a tahini dressing.
Oh my goodness. What a smorgasbord you got going on there. That sounds incredible.
Yeah, absolutely. And those hawkwing mushrooms just bring out so many of those great meaty flavors and just accent that dish so perfectly.
Yeah, you were mentioning earlier that you were really getting into the mushrooms. And so that's good to add a little bit of that that fungus into that salad. That's a great add.
Yeah, absolutely. We love foraging. And right now it is hawkwing and porcini season in Colorado.
Well, Kate, this has been an amazing talk. I appreciate so much that you take the time to join us and being on a podcast for the first time. It's been a ton of fun. This is your chance to do a shameless plug. My listeners, they're going to want to know more. They're going to want to hear about Western Daughters. They're going to want to follow you on all the social medias. Where can we find you? Where can we find Western Daughters? And where can we hear more from you?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can find me mostly on Instagram. I'm not so much for Twitter. At Kate Kavanaugh, and that's K-A-T-E_ Kavanaugh, K-A-V-A-N-A-U-G-H. And then you can read a little bit more about what we do at Western Daughters at westerndaughters.com. And if you want to drop me a line and have a chat, you can reach me at kate@westerndaughters.com on email.
Well, again, thank you, Kate, for coming and joining us tonight. It's been a great talk. I'm going to have you hold on for just a second, and I'm going to send the folks out tonight. Folks, we got some food for thought here. Not only just as we are as hunters, but at the same time, how are we interacting with our vegan friends, our vegetarian friends? Because as much as we want to say that, you know, we're different and we eat meat and they don't, we're all talking about the same environment. We're all, our food is coming from the same place. So maybe taking a good hard look at what we're doing. So anyway, folks, keep your knife sharp.